Welcome to Building Justice, a podcast by Sacramento State's Center on Race, Immigration, and Social Justice, also known as CRISJ. We explore critical issues affecting our communities with the hopes of creating a healthier and more just world. In this special edition, Defending Justice, we will be talking about the legacy of Jeff Adachi, a native of Sacramento, the holistic programs and services of the San Francisco Public Defender's Office under the leadership of current San Francisco Public Defender, Mano Raju. I'm Dr. Marie Molari, your host, and I'm here with Mano Raju, the current San Francisco Public Defender. Welcome.
Hello. Hi. How are you?
Hi, Professor.
Hey, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Public Defender Raju, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm good. Okay, so let's start this. Thank you really for you know, agreeing to do this, because I know that for a fact you have been working with Jeff for a while. And with that said, you know, with his recent, passing, what was Jeff's legacy? What did he leave?
Jeff's legacy is tremendous. One of the reasons I applied to the San Francisco Public Defender's Office to begin with was because I saw the movie Presumed Guilty. Mm-hmm. And that had a profound impact on me. I was already a public defender in Contra Costa County. I was doing quite well. Very happy there, but there was some feeling about, you know, seeing that movie, and a friend of mine was in the office and encouraged me to apply. And I did it, but I would say Jeff Adachi's legacy to me was he really wanted us to be, and they would often say this, him and Teresa Confessi was the chief attorney, the best defense money can't buy. I mean, he really wanted us to be better than private attorneys. And we wanted our clients to really, he wanted to dispel that notion of the public pretender in San Francisco. So even the idea of wearing the nice suits, coming in there, making sure our clients, you know, coming in with confidence, that was really important to him. And another big legacy of his, and, you know, that's one of the reasons he recruited me to San Francisco, is he really wanted the office to be a trial attorney office, trial focused. He was obsessed with us doing trials. And, you know, I came in as a line attorney, then was the training director, felony manager, and when he passed, I became the public defender. But I know he was thrilled that in my last year as felony manager, along with another manager in my office, our felony unit did 80 trials. And that was the first time we had done 80 trials, in Jeff Adachi's, when Jeff Adachi was the public defender. So I know he was very, very thrilled about that. And that was the last year before he passed. So I'm glad that we were able to accomplish that for him.
Right. I do know Jeff as being that. He is really a fighter. And mm-hmm. I know for a fact, you know, that because he was my mentor as well. Right. And one thing I do love about Jeff is that he never gave up.
Yes.
And one thing that I also know is that he always recruits the best.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's true.
Right.
Yeah. So how has it been since the sudden passing of Jeff? And now you are now the public defender appointed by Mayor London Breed. What have you accomplished? And I know this is a lot, and you can just talk about it.
It was a real, obviously, a sudden shock for a lot of us when Jeff passed away. And, you know, in many ways, the office, a lot of us were grieving, and a lot of us are still grieving in one capacity or another. But I know that Jeff would want us to try to be the best in every single capacity that we could. I mean, that's something that he was really obsessed with. And I'm trying to continue that in a number of different ways. I'm really interested in us being an aggressive trial office. You know, and when we talk about the triangle of public defense, we're warriors on the one hand, we're also activists and change agents, and we are also facilitators trying to get our clients to a better place. And and he, you know, started the MAGIC program. And part of one thing he talked about is we're trying to work our way out of a job. We're trying to provide the conditions and uplift youth so that they don't actually come into the system to begin with. And that's our MAGIC programs. And we're continuing to grow our MAGIC programs. But I'm trying to push on as many fronts as possible. I went through a strategic planning process and where I'm thinking very intentionally about how do we defend at the highest level? And that means all of our units, our youth defender unit, our misdemeanor unit, our felony unit, our immigration unit, all of the units. How do we, our post-conviction relief unit, how do we confront state-sponsored violence and advocate for community power, which is our policy unit? And then how do we get the operations going as smoothly as possible so that we can get data from the defenders to the policy people so that we can make the kind of systematic change we need to make? So I've been intentional about doing a strategic planning and really being forward-thinking. How can we, you know, have a 3-year vision, and then a lot of that vision, what's the 18th month vision, then what are some measurables? So we've had a lot of new initiatives. We started, we expanded our Clean Slate program threefold by reaching out to foundations. We have started our End the Cycle program, which are boots on the ground case managers connecting our clients with services. We have the first public police misconduct database connected to a public defender's office in the country. We started the youth Young Defender Program, which is a paid high school internship for public school students so that they can get exposed to all the different professions that we have, investigator, paralegal, social worker, attorney, clerical, IT staff. We started the Freedom Project, which is a project of bringing people home who have been in custody for decades sometimes, and either determining that it was a wrongful conviction or if the judge now got discretion to strike one of the enhancements, we're doing that. We've actually sued ICE because of the horrific conditions during COVID, and we were able to get a lot of people home. We started the first of its kind in the country, Be the Jury Project. In the past, if you had a financial hardship, you would be excused from the jury. Now in San Francisco, if you have a financial hardship, you'll be paid $100 a day. I reached out to the treasurer, and so we've eliminated financial hardships in San Francisco. And we started a filmmaking project, and my predecessors named the Adachi Project, because we know we need narratives if we're going to actually move policy. We made 3 films so far, and we're doing other things with the Adachi Project, but we're trying to move on that front too. So it's a extremely exciting time right now in the public defender's office, and I'm really happy about all of our new initiatives.
My goodness, that's a lot. Like, seriously, that's a lot from the time that you sat as public defender, and to think we had the pandemic. So how did that all come in play? Because the pandemic was pretty much, everything was on halt. So
yeah, it was, a very unique challenge. I don't know if we've ever been in that situation before where you're trying to run a public defender's office, a public law office, which is a very in-person profession, when the city is telling us we can only be in 20% time, which is right. Makes it very challenging. So, we had to adapt, and we got through it. It was very challenging there, but we managed, and we kept on fighting. And one of the things that we actually did is because the courts were delaying cases way past the speedy trial deadline, and which is a real problem for our clients because they have the right to that speedy trial. We don't have that hard trial date. That's our only weapon is our ability to prepare for case, do the investigation. We don't control and try cases. We don't control what's charged. We don't control if our clients are in custody, but we do control getting ready for trial quickly and vindicating our clients' rights. So when that was taken away, We took the bold step, and I, along with the family members of our clients, actually sued the Superior Court, and we're asking for injunctive relief to make sure they prioritize and use every space. And to me, you know, I took an oath, and I actually took it to Mario Wood's mom that we are going to fight, you know, and leave no stone unturned in the battle for our clients, and particularly in the racial justice era, this era renewed sense of the need for, you know, commitment to racial justice in light of the moment, the George Floyd moment that we're in. And a lot of the clients are mostly BIPOC, Black and Brown clients who were in custody well past their last day. So that's something, you know, we were pushing for, and we're going to continue to push and be an aggressive trial office while we're doing all the other things. So to me, it's not an or, it's an and. And I think in this moment, meaning the moment, this George Floyd, post-George Floyd tragedy moment means that we have to push to be the highest, practice at the highest level in court, and also do the vigorous policy and community empowerment work on while we're doing simultaneously. I mean, and like you, I came from an ethnic studies background, actually. I TA'd in the ethnic studies department at Berkeley twice while I was in law school. Yeah. Ethics, race in the law, and also race in the U.S. With Carlos Munoz when I was at Berkeley, one of the founders of the ethnic studies movement. So it's sort of coming full circle and bringing that into public defender world is something that I'm trying to do.
Great. It's great you mentioned that, because as a professor, I bring all my experience that I've done working with Jeff and working for Jeff, and I bring it to the university and to my students. I never cease to tell them what the reality is when it comes to injustice. And that's right. Right? It's really just an injustice world out there. So moving on to my third question, how do you see yourself at the helm of the San Francisco Public Defender's Office moving forward as we're going into a re-election?
Okay. You know, that's a great question. You know, in San Francisco is the only county in California, and one of the only couple in the country, where there's an elected public defender. And that's why I'm taking advantage of this election season to really try to educate people about the potential of public defender, how much public defender power can really accomplish. The prevalence of wrongful convictions, which often happen by plea. It's not always the case you hear about where there is a trial and you find DNA 30 years later. They happen every single day in courtrooms, and they happen because of overcharging. They happen because of a trial tax where judges intimidate people into thinking, intimidate our clients and say that they're going to give them much more time if they don't take this deal. And they happen because of pretrial detention. So, and educating the public about them, and educating the public about our, for example, our End the Cycle program, how public defenders care deeply about public safety. Public defenders really care about community health and giving us on-the-ground case managers and social workers that can connect clients, really connect clients in a culturally competent way with needs, whether that's how to access benefits, a class at City College, a labor apprenticeship program, substance abuse counseling, a mentor, or accessing benefits that they may not be aware of, or a combination of those. That can do so much more for public safety for a fraction of the cost of more law enforcement. So I think that this is a moment. I'm also in the San Francisco Democratic Party, and a lot of people reach out to me for my endorsement, and I'm a citywide elected official. So it's important, I think, that I embrace the importance of it being a political position, because there's an elected sheriff and there's an elected district attorney in the ear of every legislator from every county in San Francisco. There's that elected sheriff and that elected district attorney, but there's only one elected public defender. So I think it's really important that I embrace that and try to mobilize the political will of the people in San Francisco to try to bring about the change that needs to happen in our legal system.
Thank you for that. What do you want our listeners to know about the San Francisco Public Defender's Office and the importance of your work and the work of everyone at the Public Defender's Office? Because not everyone are attorneys, but that everyone plays a part.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about that.
Sure. One is, I think I want people to know that we have a very creative public defender's office. I mean, I myself have tried almost every single kind of case from, you know, simple battery or assault misdemeanors to simple possession, all the way up to every kind of case that carries a life sentence that you can imagine. And I'm really obsessed with how do we try to do everything within our power to ensure wrongful convictions don't happen, from empowering clients and getting to know clients, to bringing in community experts to bridge the gap between jurors and sometimes where communities that our clients, many of our clients come from, to, you know, really honing the craft of presenting stories, the reality, you know, revealing truth and demanding justice in courtrooms, and doing that, you know, consistently, and really trying to use the courtroom skillfully to make sure that jurors don't come to the wrong decision. And that's something I'm very committed to, and very committed to making sure we don't have defenders who are, you know, taking the easy way out or don't have that growth mindset to constantly improve. But you're right, we are much more than trial attorneys, and half of our office is not. We have paralegals who are really supporting the work that we do in trial. We have investigators who are leaving no stone unturned in investigation, even though we're severely outnumbered by the police department. We have social workers who are really connecting our clients with appropriate services out there. They're going to keep all of us safe. I've been really intentional about trying to get the pieces in place we need to make the policy changes we need to make. So I've managed to get funding from the Board of Supervisors for a data person so we can start collecting the data that we need to make the appropriate changes. More communications staff members so we can start doing more of that. So I want the public to know that the public defender's office, by fighting hard against wrongful convictions, really does a lot for community health, healthy communities, healthy families, and public safety. Because when someone gets wrongfully convicted, they're on probation or parole or doing time, and they're not there for their family. And that makes the whole family more unstable. That makes their son or daughter or nephew with that the person who's incarcerated can't support more vulnerable, more potentially susceptible to, you know, needing to resort to theft or something like that just to support themselves, right? So if we can get, not have people get convicted and do more time and be on what's called paperwork, parole or probation for longer than they should be, that actually helps public safety. But also we're in a unique position because we are mission driven, because we have people who deeply care about our clients, to really, you know, connect those clients in the right way so they can have that growth that they need to have. And lastly, I would say that from a policy level, because we represent 25,000 most vulnerable members in our society every year, and the work we do impacts not just them, but also their family, their ecosystem, potentially the next generation, that we really need to be at the policy table. Because a lot of people are talking about what kind of policy changes need to happen, but we really, very tangible level, understand the real practical reality on our clients and how that spills over to everyone else. And I think COVID was a good example. You know, with COVID, we realized that if we don't, you know, you say, sometimes we say society is only as, only, you have, you can judge a society by how it treats its most vulnerable. But in, we saw in COVID that that really was the case. When we don't take care of our most vulnerable who are incarcerated, who may get COVID, when they come out, it's going to affect everyone else and spreads, right? So we have to make sure we were treating people if they needed to be incarcerated, which, you know, I think, you know, so many should not have been. But if someone is incarcerated, we really should have made sure it was only, you know, that the conditions were such that, you know, COVID wouldn't be spreading, and that's very difficult to do. So, you know, we were intentional about trying to get as many people out, but you really saw that impact of, you know, how you treat your most vulnerable is going to impact everyone else in a medical way, right?
I agree.
But I think that's also the case sociologically, because if we don't treat the most vulnerable well, then, you know, the things that people are upset about, like the car break and things like that, are going to be more common. So.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Thank you. Yeah, those are really good points on that. And I want to end or conclude, at least for this part, a message to the community at large on the upcoming election on November 8th. Why is it important?
It's super important that our community exercise our right to vote. And it's really important that we send a message that our public defender's office is super important. The work we're doing is vital. I believe we're the best public defender's office in the country, but I'm not satisfied with where we're at. I'm constantly looking, what is that innovation? What is that extra staff member? What is that operation thing that we can operationalize to get us to the next level? And we've already had a number of things that are, you know, somewhat groundbreaking in this field, and I'm not satisfied. And I think when you get a bunch of passionate people who are really willing to work hard in an office like ours, care about racial justice, who care about fighting for some of the most vulnerable people in our society, who care about the inequities, who really want to fight with skill and passion and put in the work, there's a tremendous amount that's possible. And I think that if the voters send a mandate and reelect me, hopefully that can also translate into the growing budget needs that we have to make. And I tell City Hall all the time, I think we'll do more with 10 cents than a lot of agencies will do with $10. And investing in us can have such a positive impact on society, particularly when we, you know, getting back to the ethnic studies, are connecting with community-based organizations and all, you know, the whether it's the API Community Hut or the Willie Brown Center in Sunnydale or a Latino Task Force or some of our strong Asian organizations that are doing amazing work. That potential public defender power coupled with strong community-based organizations can just do so much for our health and start to rectify some of the legacy of racial injustice that's unfortunately been a virus in this country.
Well, thank you. And thank you very much, right? I really love the fact, Manoah, that you are ethnic studies. I really do. And I think this is really important because many people right now do not understand why ethnic studies is a requirement. Mm-hmm. As you know, the governor signed AB 1460, and I was very into the campaign for that. I actually brought a lot of people into the Capitol to actually lobby, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And ethnic studies together with fighting for justice was just a natural thing.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, another initiative is that we've been really active in Sacramento. We were very close to getting the Biden Act passed, which would have prevented the double punishment and, you know, people being transferred and deported from, you know, state and local custody. Exactly. Yeah. So that's just so important because so many times the immigration consequences for our clients are actually much more severe than the criminal consequences of it. And you know, the cooperation between state agencies and ICE is something that needs to stop. And, you know, we were very close to getting that passed. But also, you know, we were active in Sacramento and were successful in shortening probation terms for many offenses because it's very common for the prosecutor to make an offer and say, you can go home today, get out of jail, but we're going to put you on probation for 5 years. And then that individual, you know, can't really move on with their life. And it's very difficult to say no to that when you're in jail, right? So we went to Sacramento along with, you know, other partners, and we were successful in putting a cap of 2 years for many felonies and a cap of 1 year for many misdemeanors. We were also successful in making some reforms to the gang law, which has historically been really oppressive against Black and Brown community members who going to trial, and they're sort of trying to deal with one. We're trying to focused on one incident, and the prosecution is just bringing in all sorts of other stuff that has nothing to do with the incident. And we got some changes, including getting the word organized into the statute so that, you know, so many Black and brown youth and Tay individuals and people in general would not be swept into gang prosecutions unfairly. So I've been very pleased with, you know, our efforts in Sacramento in trying to change the law so we can have an impact, not just on our clients, but on thousands and thousands of clients statewide.
And I would love to have you speak maybe at my class.
Love to come down there.
Yeah, or even on Zoom. Seriously,
sure,
even on Zoom.
Sure. Well, I'm happy to do it on Zoom. I'm also happy to come down there. And the thing is, you know, I've been finding there's a lot of youth who are like, they're in step with this moment. And we need to match where the youth are at. We need to learn from the youth and really, you know, bring, because our field, you know, I'm a justice partner in a sense, and I'm often, you know, in meetings with the sheriff and the district attorney and the chief of police. But oftentimes I'm also in community with youth and with, you know, some powerful community-based organizations. And really, the public defender, we have to be in both worlds. And I think it's so vital. And I'm really trying to forge those bonds and do that raising of consciousness, because sometimes what we're doing is we're moving the bar for what's possible. Like, we want to make the policy changes now, but we also want to change the field of consciousness so more positive changes can come in the years going forward.
I would like to thank sfgovtv.org, sfnewsfeed.us, and Matt Gonzalez's reader. Thank you to my audio engineer and editor, Javar Henry. On behalf of my colleagues at the Center on Race, Immigration, and Social Justice at Sac State University, thanking you for tuning in to our podcast, Building Justice. I'm Dr. Marie Molare with San Francisco Public Defender Mano Raju. We hope our ongoing conversations spark understandings, empathies, and motivation to join the struggle for a better future for all.
All the penalties and the rewards based on the actions. Now, time for building justice.